Hello friends, you're listening to 4 Qubits in a Span. I'm Dan Abson.
And I'm Nathan Kitchen.
Welcome back to the show. Following up from my guest last week, we've got another of my friends on this week. Nathan Kitchen's joining us from Birmingham, UK. Hi, Nath.
Hi, Dan.
We're going to have fun this week. We've got 1 Chronicles chapter 15, Ezekiel 27, and Luke chapter 24. Although, as we were just discussing, Luke might get shortchanged again a little bit this week, but we'll see how that goes. In 1 Chronicles this week, or this coming week, we're reading all about David's accession to the throne and his consolidation, the consolidation of his rule with a string of military victories. In Ezekiel, we're going back to the idea of what the purpose of prophecy is and what the purpose of Ezekiel's ministry was, and how we're supposed to read that today, so far removed from all the events that it's describing. And we've got our last chapter of Luke. We've been with Luke for, I think, 4 weeks. Yeah, this is our fourth week with Luke. Here in the last chapter, we've got the resurrection narrative and all the stuff that Luke does to set up the continuing story in Acts, which we'll be coming to in a few weeks. Okay, let's start in 1 Chronicles chapter 15. There's a really interesting account that I really want to pick up on here. And that's where David moves the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem. A couple of chapters previously in the Chronicles record, he had a go. It didn't go that well. Poor old Uzzah stuck out his hand because it looked like the Ark was going to fall off the cart. And he died because God killed him, because he was angry. We're not going to go into that just now. But what we are going to look at, just briefly in chapter 15, is how David makes it right. And the parallel account is in 2 Samuel chapter 6. There's a parallel record there. And that runs both of the incidents together. It starts with Uzzah at the beginning of the chapter, and then tells of how David succeeds in bringing the Ark to Jerusalem later. But the Chronicles version is much more elaborate. Last week with Nat, we were talking about how the chronicler grounds his audience, or how the chronicler grounds the Israelites in the land, and how the connections with the genealogies all help to ground his present audience with the narrative that he's telling, with the history that he's telling. And there's a couple of sections of genealogy in this chapter of the Levites and the clans and the chieftains of those clans and the various descendants and ancestors to establish who was there and who did stuff during this move of the Ark to Jerusalem. And the Samuel record doesn't do any of that. In the Samuel record, it's actually pretty simple. Back in 2 Samuel chapter 6, all David does differently this time, apart from making sure that no one touches the Ark, presumably, is it's in verse 13, well, it starts in verse 12 into verse 13 of 2 Samuel 6. The bearers of the Ark of the Lord go 6 steps, and then David sacrifices a bull and a buffalo. He was wearing a linen ephod, and he danced with abandon before the Lord, as he and all the Israelites brought up the Ark of the Lord with acclamation and blowing of trumpets. And that's it. That's all he has to do. He dances 6 steps, does kill some animals, and dances right on into Jerusalem. It's a lot more elaborate in 1 Chronicles, and it's especially interesting to notice all of the different emphases between the two records. In 2 Samuel, it's about all the Israelites, all the people. That phrase is repeated several times. In the Chronicles record, the chronicler very specifically notes that David decrees that only the Levites should carry the Ark of God, since they had been chosen by the Lord to carry it and to serve him forever. So practically all of this material is new over the King's record, or different, at least, to the King's record. And you have the two kind of chief priests of Jerusalem, Zadok and Abiathar, in verse 11. They're there with all the Levites. And David, not only does David not wear a linen ephod, he doesn't do any sacrificing. It's all the Levites that do all the sacrificing. The Levites take the ark. The Levites kind of organize everything. David's authority, David's right to do this is validated by the presence of the Levitical order, by the presence of the Levitical priests. The only place that all Israel is specifically noted as being involved was not actually in the transportation itself, but in the reception at Jerusalem. So whereas David took all Israel with him to transport the ark in 2 Samuel, David makes sure that they all stay in Jerusalem. That's in verse 3 of 1 Chronicles 15. David assembled all Israel at Jerusalem, and he takes the Levites to actually go and carry it. We're going to carry on to see that emphasis throughout the Chronicles record of the cult of the Levitical priests and their role in the nation's history. Nath, what have you got from this chapter? What jumps out at you?
So this is the last stage of what's been a very long journey, actually, because it kind of set off many, many years ago back in Sinai. And it's been working its way to this place that God's chosen for, let's see, hundreds of years at this point.
Yeah.
And so it's not just a case that they're moving a box. This is a ceremony that's loaded with significance for them. It's the last journey that this box is going to make before it actually arrives in the temple. And you kind of have the covenant promises starting to be fulfilled as part of that that final landing.
Yeah, that's quite striking. From towards the end of the chapter, the Ark of the Covenant, Ark of the Covenant, Ark of the Covenant is repeated like four times there. So there's a big emphasis on that idea of covenant.
Yeah.
There.
And it can also often feel like, you know, this is a reasonably mundane activity. They're moving a box from point A to point B. And we also, as part of our ritual, do some reasonably mundane things, taking bread and wine each week. But they are also loaded with a similar level of significance, and they need the same care and excitement about them that David exhibited in this passage.
Yeah, David's wife gets a little bit upset that he's so excited about it and dancing around quite so much. And it never really explains why, just that she was really happy and she despised him in her heart. Chronicler doesn't really give us any idea what's going on there.
Yeah, you're kind of left to fill in the blanks. But actually, no, God's response is back in Samuel, isn't it, that she's made barren.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, so you don't actually get this in the Chronicler. However, I think that clarifies that what she did here was a negative thing.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And so despising that excitement for something, which is a pretty mundane thing, is looked down on.
Yeah. Samuel, it does end, the chapter does end with Saul's daughter was childless to her dying day. But she seems to think that David's disgraced himself or demeaned himself or exposed himself like a common person. That's really the only motivation that we get for her not really liking it very much. The idea of foundation and grounding that we were talking about last week in Chronicles comes through in all these sort of passages about establishing worship or about the way in which worship is done in Israel and the basis on which it's done. And we're going to dive into that in a couple of weeks when we start 2 Chronicles with the dedication of the temple. But that does kind of play into this. This is kind of like David arriving as the king. This is his kind of divine authority to rule the nation is now there in his capital city. The significance, like you said, not to be underestimated for that passage. It's a pretty big thing. Cool. We're kind of champing at the bit to get to Ezekiel 27, because that's probably where we're going to spend most of this episode. So let's crack on. Let's go to Ezekiel 27. We're going to consider the couple of chapters around Ezekiel 27 as well, because this is right in the middle of a whole sort of death and destruction kind of vengeance of God section of oracles from Ezekiel, starting in chapter 25 with Ammon and Moab and, you know, all the nations round about Israel and all the dreadful things that are going to happen to them. And the oracle against Tyre starts in the previous chapter, in chapter 26, with some fairly iconic prophetic images from the Old Testament.
Yeah, Dan, you're right. There's a lot of context here, and we are jumping smack into the middle of a series of oracles, the seven oracles. And in these seven oracles, you can imagine the prophet standing in Israel, looking north, And as he turns in a clockwise direction, he kind of mows down all the nations round about with these oracles. And that's kind of what they're there for. And then this is the last one in the circuit, or the second to last one. I think there's Sidon got to come next.
Yep.
And then finally, a bit later on, he's going to turn way down south, not really to one of Israel's neighbours, but a little further away to the great power of Egypt. Mm. And so right now, he's focused on Tyre in this series of oracles.
Yeah, and he's God's bringing Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, the king of kings, this is chapter 26, verse 7, with basically an overwhelming force, horses, chariots, cavalry, infantry, to wreak the judgment of God on Tyre.
Yeah, and he does so in this continued and repeated oracle genre. Now, Ezekiel is just full up of these literary structures, which you can very easily read through or read over without quite grasping the structure that is actually there in many of these chapters that we're reading. One of those structures is called halving. It's something that Ezekiel does quite often. He sort of repeats a message twice, hence halving. Huh. But it does leave you having to piece together these two halves to try and work out the picture that's being drawn for us. In these halves, you also find that sometimes there's a doom panel where everything's bad, followed by a salvation panel. And in these particular oracles, it's pretty much doom and doom. But you do find there's an awful lot of repetition. Now, the way you identify these halves is by looking out for things called formulas. So, for example, one of those formulas might be the citation formula, which starts with, "Thus says the Lord," or whatever the equivalent is in your version.
Yep.
And they might end with something like a recognition formula, which would be, "Then they shall know that I am the Lord." And if you go through these chapters and you start highlighting those, you'll start to see other formulas, other phrases that will come up multiple times, and you'll start to see that structure pop out at you. Now, within those halves, you'll also then find that there are passages which start with, "Because such and such a thing has happened," or "Because such and such an attitude has been shown, therefore this series of events are going to happen to you." And you'll find that when you spot those formulas, when you spot the halves, you'll start to see the structure of the oracle jump out at you, and you start to understand what the problem is and how God's going to deal with it. Now, through Ezekiel and through the oracles we've seen so far, one of the things that will jump out is the idea of poetic justice. So, in the oracle against Moab, Moab are accused of saying that, you know, Israel aren't special. And so, what God does is God makes their special cities forgotten. Hmm. Edom. So, there's an oracle against Edom. And Edom are accused of taking vengeance on Israel. So God takes vengeance on them. And then we come to Tyre. We have this Tyre being a coastal city with a great maritime economy. And you know what? It gets sunk in the middle of the sea. This idea of poetic justice is kind of laced throughout all these oracles and throughout the structure that's in them as well.
Yeah, that's really nice. This is one of the things I really struggle with. All these sort of prophetic oracles, you've got passages like this through all the major prophets, and I really genuinely don't really know what to do with them. So it's kind of helpful to see that structure and to have a framework, really, for being able to read it and not just get totally lost and make up some random weirdness to explain everything.
Right. And part of the problem of that is, first of all, reading over the structure, because that, to start with, can make it difficult to get to the nub of what's going on. The other problem, as I've kind of mentioned, poetic justice. And there's one part of that I want to talk a bit more about, actually. It's the idea of poetry. So there's an awful lot of poetry and an awful lot of wordplay and some very clever ideas popping up in these chapters. It's absolutely laced with things like similes. If we go back to, I think it was verse 4, we read that God is going to destroy Tyre as the sea by bringing up nations against it as the sea brings up its waves. Now, the text doesn't really go out of its way to explain what that means, but it could have given you a really nice, quite clear definition. You know, first we're going to have one wave which will do some damage, and then there'll be another wave that'll do more damage. But you're kind of left to try and determine yourself how exactly the sea bringing up its waves is going to compare with the destruction of this particular city. And it doesn't attempt to resolve that ambiguity for you. It just leaves it hanging there and starts to have more of an effect on you in the images that it brings to mind. I mean, for me, it would be like a sandcastle slowly getting eaten away as this inevitable tide comes in. But it, you know, as the sea brings up its waves, could to someone else, they might imagine crashing waves coming straight over it and wiping it all out in one shot.
Yeah.
So you're not really led through the application of that prophecy. It would be very hard in advance to predict what's going to happen. Sure, some nation's going to come up, like the sea brings up its waves, and you know, you could try and figure out what sea means and what waves mean, but you're going to ultimately miss the point of what that text is trying to tell you, which is that it's going to be totally destroyed. And that's what happens after the tide has come in, hasn't it? There's nothing really left on the beach. No more sandcastles.
That would make a great name for a book on prophetic interpretation. No more sandcastles.
I'll bear that in mind. So there's another phrase in there, which is like the top of a rock. That's what Tyre is going to be made like, the top of a rock. And it, the text does nothing to really explain what attribute of rocks and the top of rocks the Tyre is going to exist in this state of being like the top of a rock. However, when you take the whole verse together, you start to see the picture it's drawing for you. So they're going to destroy the walls of Tyre in 26 verse 4. They're going to break down her towers, scrape her soil from her, and make her a bare rock. And there's this kind of progression there of this slow destruction, which is a complete destruction, that where there's absolutely nothing left at the end of it. Now, you've got to ask yourself, you know, what is God trying to do here? Is he trying to give us a future description of a place we can go to spread our nets? Because that's the next thing he tells us, is, you know, this is a great place for spreading nets. Now, is that actually important? Is that what God's trying to tell us? You know, you really need a good spot for drying your nets. You should go to Tyre in a couple of years. this isn't what it's trying to do. I'll give an example of a way that people use language in this way. So I went out recently for a curry with a friend. And as I was reading through the menu, I found a particularly hot curry and thought, you know what, I might order that one. And he smiled across the table and said, yep, you better put the loo roll in the fridge. Now then, you can go and you can look up every word in that sentence in a dictionary or in Strong's Concordance, and you will not understand the meaning of that because it's so loaded with context. And from seeing you on the webcam there, I can tell it's had the same effect on you.
I'm going to remember that one.
This is the power of poetic language. This is why you talk about utter destruction. It becomes a place for spreading nets because there's nothing to stop you. There's no objects left on the top of that rock. There's no houses. There's literally nothing there. Now, it's not there to say, you know, one day at some point in time, the guy is going to stand on that rock and spread a net. That's not the point. The point is that there'll be nothing there.
Yeah.
The whole place will be utterly destroyed.
Yeah, that's helpful because we can get over, we can become literal without being literary. That's a useful distinction to bring out.
Yeah. It's not unusual or unique particularly to prophecy either. You can think of the prophets as covenant enforcers. They are going around the country and giving people these messages as part of a mandate to enforce and to bring people to a realization of this covenant that they're in with their God.
Yeah.
Yeah. So these prophets are going around the country and they are trying to motivate the people to come back to their God and to be faithful to him and to be faithful to this covenant. And this covenant has been portrayed earlier in the Bible in these terms, which are absolute extremes. On one side, if you do all the things right, if you are faithful to your God, then you will have everything that you could ever want as a citizen of an agrarian society. Or everything that could possibly go wrong will go wrong, and it will be absolutely terrible. And these are the sort of terms of the covenant, because these were the terms of covenants that were written in those days. And the Bible follows that same pattern of using that extreme language. Now, we might look at it and think, you know, can't we just have some nice, easy factual language. You know, if you do A, then B will happen. And it would be all very dry and quite legalistic, I think. But what we have instead in the Bible is this very poetic, this very powerful language, which is there to give people either hope or to warn them about some terrible consequences that are going to happen. Because really, their survival, and especially their long-term survival, is at stake. And here in Ezekiel as well, the effect is to give people hope that these people who had slighted them will be judged, to encourage the people of Israel to overlook short-term problems and instead adopt a longer-term view, if you like, a divine view, in which eventually justice triumphs and we have judgment and salvation poured out on the people who are respectively worthy of that.
Yeah, if we were looking at it literarily, we might call it a kind of hyperbole.
Yeah, and much of the Bible uses that. And actually, if you sit down and go through these oracles, and also especially this oracle of Tyre, you can be surprised how much of that is laced through the text. There's very little of it which names something concrete. Like, for example, the one example there is actually Nebuchadnezzar.
Yeah.
He does make it into the text as a specific thing that's going to happen. But the rest of it, sometimes you can be really torn as to whether we should take something literally or not.
Yeah, yeah.
If you put yourself back to a point before Tyre was destroyed, I think you'd have a right job trying to figure out what you thought was going to happen. A bit later on, we're not quite there yet, but in tomorrow's chapter, in chapter 28, we also have the prophecy against the prince of Tyre and against the king of Tyre as well. And that talks about how he will be destroyed. So in chapter 28 and verse 18, by the multitude of your iniquities, in the unrighteousness of your trade, you profaned your sanctuaries. So I brought fire out from your midst and it consumed you. And I turned you to ashes on the earth in the sight of all who saw you. Literal? Poetic? Symbol of general destruction? What is this?
Yeah, that's the challenge.
We don't jump out and start saying, you know, oh, was he burned to death? Yeah, because that's what a literal type reading would give you. So to just jump on a couple of passages and try to work out if they were fulfilled in a particular way, again, kind of misses the point of what the prophet's trying to get you to do, which is change your behaviour.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, a couple of chapters later on, in chapter 29, Ezekiel actually has a record of Nebuchadnezzar's siege against Tyre. We're looking at verse 17, 18. So Nebuchadnezzar takes all of his armies, he besieges Tyre. We know historically that's a 13-year siege. And Ezekiel's comment is, no gain from Tyre accrued to him or to his army from their campaign. This, therefore, is the word of the Lord God. I am now giving Egypt to King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. So all of that kind of like raising with fire, spreading of nets on bare rock, that didn't happen for Nebuchadnezzar, and Ezekiel's fine with it. He's like, yeah, that didn't happen. It's okay, you can have Egypt instead. They've got some cool stuff. Take that.
Yeah, and again, it kind of comes back to this whole idea of the nations coming up against them, of which Nebuchadnezzar was the first, and slowly them ebbing away into insignificance. You're right, I mean, Nebuchadnezzar didn't finish them off. Neither did Alexander sometime later.
Yeah.
Neither did really the Seleucids, even later than that.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were even still trading during Jesus' day.
Yeah, by the time you get to the first century, Tyre and Sidon they're oppressing the Jews by that point, the Judean, the provinces of Judea. They're the main merchants. They're still setting the prices and taking all the stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, it took a long time for them to really waste away. And I would argue that that's, we can look back on it and we can try to make analogies to, you know, the sea coming up with its waves and talk about sandcastles and the tide slowly and inevitably coming in. But you'd be very hard pressed to have predicted that straight off the bat from the text that we have in Ezekiel here. It's not there for us to try and predict the future about it. And even its apologetics value also isn't super, super high, because it's written in such poetic language
that
it's very difficult to interpret it in a historical way, because it's not written in a historical way.
Yeah. Yeah, I've done that. I've been there. I've done that. I've given that talk in Alexander's siege in the 4th century BCE. I trotted out the hole, they threw down the buildings and made this big causeway. So it was really thrown into the sea, hooray! That's what it says in chapter 26, verse 12. Your walls will be levelled, your fine houses pulled down, the stones, timber and rubble will be dumped in the sea. So I've done that, I've given that talk, and then later regretted it for all the same reasons that you've just given.
Yeah.
That it doesn't have value as that kind of, in that kind of setting.
Absolutely. And it's not that particular aspect of the prophecy is insignificant and that it isn't unusual and that it didn't happen in this surprising poetic justice to Tyre. It certainly happened. But from an apologetics perspective, it's very difficult to say, you know, that was the end of it. And all those things were immediately fulfilled by Alexander. That's not what it was there for. And it's actually not what happened either.
Yeah.
I mean, the harder one for me is actually the statement that Tyre will never be rebuilt, which is quite a hyperbole to start with.
Yeah, Tyre will never be rebuilt except for when it's Carthage and except for when it gets independence from the Seleucids and, like, carries on being this major trading port all through the medieval times.
Yeah, but in the context of the poetic language of the whole oracle, it makes perfect sense. Yeah. They're going to be utterly wiped out. Now, Tyre was a maritime economic power. You know, they had a city, they had a sea fortress, they had a king, they had a navy, and that Tyre was slowly washed away over hundreds of years as nation after nation crashed over them. Nobody really ever managed to build Tyre in those terms, you know, as a city, a sea fortress, the king and the navy. That Tyre has ceased to be. And to suggest that, you know, now there is a village on that current site called Tyre, but to suggest that somehow it invalidates the prophecy kind of misunderstands the message of the prophet and who he was talking to and why he was talking about all this stuff in the first place.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's interesting that you drew attention to the prince who bursts into fire, except not really, in chapter 28, because the royal family after Nebuchadnezzar's siege, the siege seems to have been ended by a treaty, and the royal house of Tyre all get taken off to Babylon, so they are removed from power. Mm. Obviously, they don't literally burst into fire. But yeah, they're out of the equation. They remove from power and Tyre becomes the central foundation of Carthage after that. So there is a sense, I guess, like you said, for the purpose that Ezekiel's writing to the people that he's writing, this is what happens in their day, in their circumstances, in this kind of literary sort of prophetic oracle kind of way.
Yeah, it's not isolated in any way to Ezekiel either. Just to drop on another example, if you were to talk about Solomon, mm-hmm. and you were to think about the prophecy in which the kingdoms are going to be torn away from his children, given to another, right? Torn away from him, given to someone else. Except they weren't really torn. It's, I mean, you could put far too much emphasis talking to Solomon about them being torn away from him, and they weren't. They came to him. There was a minor dispute with his children, actually, and they left.
Yeah.
But the overall effect of, yes, they will be torn away from his line. He's got no way of getting them back. It will be irreparably damaged. That part of the analogy holds really, really well. And it actually, for me, understanding prophecy as much about analogy and applied metaphor actually solves a number of problems. So if you were to then go to a difficult prophecy like Hosea in chapter 11, verse 1. When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. Now, you are never reading that prophecy on your own going to think, ha, this is a prophecy about Jesus. And yet, we get to the New Testament, and it's kind of applied like that, and we kind of look at it and think, oh, wow, were we supposed to get that from reading Hosea? Because I missed that when I was reading the Old Testament. Yeah. I can kind of see that there's a relationship there, that God has called Israel, and that he's also called his son. Like, there's a similarity there, but I wouldn't have predicted it. But again, the prediction isn't the point. The point is it's echoing the same language, the same metaphor, the same shape. We might call it a type. It's a fulfillment of a type, and that's why it's a fulfillment of prophecy, because the language of prophecy is this metaphor and similes and allusions and types. And it can be imprecise, but it's also far more powerful than just giving you a dry run of a list of future events that are going to take place.
Yeah, I love that idea of a type or like a repeating pattern, something that later writers and later commentators use to connect present day events with past events. Because that happens all the way through as we're going through. We looked at that last week, and as we're going through Chronicles, you can't not see those things when you're really looking for them. The way that if you're bearing in mind who the Chronicle is writing to, for example, that he's writing to the people back in the land, the exiles rebuilding Jerusalem, reestablishing worship in the temple, you can't help but then read the narrative of the first temple through that lens. And the chronicler identifies as these kind of repeating patterns. And Matthew, as you say, he identifies these, you might call them types, kind of prophetic passages which speak about the present time as well. And Matthew uses that to connect the continuing story of Israel with the past history of Israel.
Yeah, which is powerful. That has an effect upon the reader. And that's what they were aiming for. That's why they're using the text in that way. Because it was kind of left open for them to use it like that. Which is an interesting kind of hallmark of inspiration, I suppose.
Yeah, the bit from the episode in Isaiah 7 a couple of weeks ago that I chopped out for length about Ahaz and Hezekiah. You read that and you go, a young woman's going to have a child, and that child's going to do everything right that you did wrong. And we've got that in Hezekiah. He does everything right that Ahaz does wrong. But then when we get to Matthew's reading the Septuagint, so he's got virgin, and he says, yeah, this is what happened. This is about Jesus.
Yeah.
And you kind of do a double take. And until you start thinking about it in the terms that you've just described, which I think is really helpful.
Yeah, I found it useful to start thinking about the Bible more like that. And for what it's worth, it also helps us to quantify the value of word cross-reference type study that goes on.
Yeah.
So I've already made a slight allusion to, you know, my sentence, which you could look up every single word in that sentence, and you would not get the meaning behind it. Now, in the Bible, what you're likely to do is if you go and you find, I don't know, a passage like the dogs are going to lick up their blood, which is another great, very graphic way of describing someone's destruction, which was literally fulfilled in some of those narratives. Now, if you go and look up some of the words in that, you might stumble across the other passages. And so you start to connect up the ideas, which is like great, because they are the ideas that are riffing off one another and building to a more cohesive picture.
Yeah.
But if you go just to words and connect them to other words, you're just going to find a list of words that occur in the Bible. It's when these ideas mesh together that you start to find these recurring themes, and you start to realize who's working on other passages and how they're using them, and not sometimes reinterpreting them in new ways to take new messages to their readers.
Yeah, that's really powerful. And in the second half of Ezekiel 27, this image of all the merchants, all the sailors, the helmsmen, the merchants, the warriors, all the people who had financially benefited from trade with Tyre, or from the sort of the Phoenician merchant empire of Tyre, when they see Tyre desolate in the midst of the sea, they're distraught. They're mourning aloud. They're throwing dust over their heads, putting on sackcloth, weeping bitterly. And this same image is borrowed by the writer of Revelation. In Revelation 18, that's exactly the same description of the merchants and all the people who benefited from Babylon. And when they see Babylon being destroyed, this is what they do. And so the writer of Revelation is doing exactly that. He's taking this image from Ezekiel, from the sort of literary past of Israel, and he's applying it to a new situation and going, this thing that happened before, this thing's going to happen again. And it's going to be like this. If Babylon's really is code, sort of early Christian code for Rome, then that makes this image from Ezekiel incredibly potent for the writer of Revelation and for his audience. And for saying, this sort of cultural touchstone that you've got, this is relevant to you now, and here's why. And yet, like you said, that makes it a really powerful way to talk about the purpose of God.
Yeah, because those allusions say more than just referencing a chapter and a verse.
Yeah, exactly.
They're far more rich than that.
Yeah, and it means you can leave so much stuff unsaid because you know that your readers are going to recognize that allusion, and they're going to go back and they're going to remember the context and remember what happened before and afterwards and during, and it's going to be like, this is relevant to me, this is what's going to happen, this is like the assurance of God to me that he is still working in the same way that he always did with Israel. So you've got this whole sort of wealth of kind of cultural history and literary history where you can leave all this stuff unspoken and like not get executed by the Roman Empire as some kind of political dissident. Cool.
On to Luke then?
Yes, let's do Luke. Chapter 24. Finishing our journey through the Gospel with Luke this week. Through the readings this week, Jesus arrives at Jerusalem. He's challenging it to accept God's Messiah on very different terms to what the Jews at the time would have been expecting. And he's then killed, and we get to the resurrection narrative, Luke's triumphant conclusion. He finishes off the gospel in a very similar way to how he begins the gospel. He began the gospel with the testimony of faithful women, and he ends the gospel with the testimony of faithful women. He started with Elizabeth and Mary. We thought about that in our second episode where we were doing Luke chapter 2. And that's exactly what happens again at the end of the gospel in verse 55 actually of chapter 23. The women who had accompanied Jesus from Galilee followed. They took note of the tomb and saw his body laid in it. And they go home, prepare the spices, rest on the Sabbath day. And very early on the first day of the week, this is verse 1 of our chapter 24, they came to the tomb bringing the spices they had prepared, and they're the ones who first find out that Jesus is risen. They get the message, they go to tell the 11 and all the others, so the apostles and all the other disciples, and in this kind of ironic validation of the women's testimony, none of the others believe a word they say. So all the apostles, all these other disciples, none of them believe a word these women say, but of course we know that they are right. And as we commented back in that other chapter, first century Mediterranean world, testimony of women not really worth anything. Except for Luke, who puts them right up there with all the other marginalized people that he shows Jesus reaching out to in his gospel. The angel that announces the resurrection to these women actually confirms for us that they were there all along while Jesus was teaching. We saw this back in sort of chapters 8 and 9. But the angel says, remember how he told you while he was still in Galilee that the Son of Man must be given into the power of sinful men and be crucified and rise again on the third day. So they already knew all of this because they'd been there the whole time and heard all that teaching. Luke's gospel, all about participation, all about bringing people in who had previously been excluded. Which is appropriate. He's writing presumably to Gentiles. And just to finish this gospel, Jesus shares a meal with his disciples again, with the apostles. Kind of Luke's ultimate way of including people, of showing how people participate in the gospel and in the work of Jesus, is that he shares a meal with them. He's still there. He's still the same Jesus. He's still the same human, the same person who preached to them all those years, flesh and blood, still sharing a meal with them. They're still invited to be with him and be like him, even though he's now in this sort of, on this sort of higher level. Nath, what have you got?
So one of the things that jumps out at me through this whole chapter is the repeated allusions to missed perceptions. So Luke skips all the shock and awe, the revealing of the tomb, any earthquakes, stones being rolled away, all of this. And he just goes straight for these people arriving at the tomb. And you know what? They were pretty confused. They were much perplexed thereabouts, as the King James calls it. So as much as anything, these people are confused by the resurrection. So they go and get Peter. Peter turns up. And you know what? He departs wondering what's going on as well. They really aren't seeing what's happening here. Now, that brings us quite nicely then to the next story, which is the road to Emmaus, which is all built on the idea that they haven't perceived who he is.
Nice.
And so, again, they've not recognized him, and this failure to visually perceive Christ is just a reflection of a larger oversight. They'd failed to perceive Messiah through the scriptures, and so Jesus himself is going to then reveal himself through the scriptures by talking to them and explaining who he is. And then, eventually, they perceive Jesus and his role and his work, and their sight's restored. Now, that's actually carried on even further. Once the disciples have returned from Emmaus, Jesus appears in this room. And you know what? They misperceive him again immediately. You know what? They supposed that they'd seen a spirit. They were terrified. Huh. And he says, you know, why are you troubled? Why do these thoughts arise in your hearts? You've not understood. You've misperceived again. And the ironic thing is that this whole chapter then concludes with verse 44. And Jesus says, these are the words that I spoke while I was yet with you. That all these things will be fulfilled, which were written in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms concerning me. He opened their understanding that they might understand the scriptures. And so he then sends them out just towards the end. Again, I think it's verse 48. He sends them out preaching that repentance and remission of sins should be preached in his name among all nations, beginning at Jerusalem. And ye are witnesses of these things. So for all their inability to perceive and see things correctly throughout this whole chapter, the presence of Jesus has enabled them to be witnesses of the things that they have seen. I find that quite an amusing and very powerful way of explaining how Jesus is able to open our eyes to greater truths, and without him we're kind of blind.
Nice. I really like that. That's great. I'd never really noticed that before.
Yeah, it's cool, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, that really plays into the continuing story of the gospel in Acts as well, where Luke recaps some of this at the beginning of Acts. And that's exactly how the apostles start out that narrative there in chapter 2. They are the witnesses. They're the ones who are saying, we saw all these things. This is what we saw. This is what you're going to see as well, to all the people that they're talking to. So that's a really nice thread to follow through into Acts. The idea that these people who really didn't understand anything that was going on become these most powerful witnesses to this event, and they go and convert thousands of people at a time. That's really nice.
Yeah. And all kind of started with this seed of Jesus opening all their eyes.
Yeah. I think that pretty much puts us at the end of our show for this week then. Thanks to Nathan for being here. That's been loads of fun talking through those passages with you. Thanks especially for going over the idea of prophecy with us and kind of talking us through that and making us not feel too guilty about not going out and matching up everything in a prophecy with something else.
No, thanks for having me on. It's been an absolute pleasure and great fun.
Nathan's coming back next year whenever I find some other piece of prophecy that I don't have the foggiest clue what to do with. Yeah, you'd be on quite often if I did that, I think.
To be fair, when are you doing Ezekiel 38, 39?
Ezekiel, actually, I'm not doing Ezekiel 38 and 39.
Oh, you're skipping those. That's a shame.
We've got,
oh, sorry. Well, next year when you get to that bit, I've got a ton on that, and we can do proper halving then.
That would be awesome.
Yeah, okay. Good, pull me in for that.
Cool.
I've got loads on that.
Sold. next week, we're doing 1 Chronicles 24 to 25, Ezekiel 34, and Philippians 1 and 2. That's going to be fun. Until we get to Philippians, I have literally no idea what I'm going to do with that as of this particular moment in time. But we'll think of something that's going to be a challenging passage to look at. In the meantime, come join the conversation at www.4qubitsandaspan.com on the blog page for this episode, or on the Facebook page. Just search 4 Qubits and a Span. You'll find us there. Leave comments for Nathan. I'll make sure that he sees them and comes and says wise and interesting things in response. You can do wise and interesting.
I can say things. Definitely do the things part.
Sold. We're all about the things. Come and talk to us. We can do the things. How do you say Saul's daughter's name? Is it Michal or Michael?
I always go for Michael.
I always go for Michael as well. It sounds kind of weird.
You could go for Michaela. It doesn't say that.
I'm going to call her Michaela from now on. Yeah, she gets a bit upset. I don't know what I'm going to do with that section, but I'll do something with it.
I'll leave it in.